Hello, hello. Coming to you once again from my secret location in lockdown. I am Matt Harvey, and I will once again be your bearer of weird news. Before we get started, just a quick thing. I'd like to thank you for coming back, for tuning in, for listening again. And I'd like to remind you that I've got two shows for very little amounts of money on sale from the Fringe View website, which is run via Adelaide Fringe, a storytelling show that is called I Got Bit by a Monkey Once. And I've got a news quiz, something that the people who, if you're taking time to listen to this, will probably appreciate, as I get a few of the best improvisers from the Melbourne scene in to take a quiz about the news. And you can get all those via the Fringe View website for only a couple of bucks. Now, let's get to the news. First up, in showing people how to treat you news, there are a growing cohort of MPs refusing to download the government's CoronaSafe COVID tracing app because they don't want the government all up in their business, despite themselves being the government. Condescending dad, trying to keep a slumber party under control, Scott Morrison, likened the app to a form of protection that most Australians would be familiar with, saying, it's like putting on sunscreen when you go out into the blazing sun.
I would liken it to the fact that if you want to go outside, when the sun's shining, you've got to put sunscreen on.
Except, of course, sunburn isn't contagious and makes a bad analogy, not to mention major differences being sunscreen actually works. And MPs actually use sunscreen. Well, most of them do. Whereas politicians, including Barnaby Joyce, are refusing to use the official COVID-19 contact tracing app, which, given Joyce's history of being found near people he shouldn't be near, is probably a smart move for him. In his own words, Joyce said,
"Intrusion.
I don't want the government in every corner of my life. I mean, my house has curtains, not because we're committing crimes, because we like our privacy."
While Liberal MPs are demanding data privacy guarantees, a bold hypocrisy, given they have a longer history of deception than David Copperfield, and continue to lie and deceive in increasingly audacious ways. Look at this. $1 million property, Dutton. $1 million property? How do you forget? How are you doing well enough that you can forget you have $1 million property? Maybe you need a pay cut. That money can go towards, I don't know, permanently raising welfare. The government continues to try to convince Australians the software is the key to the nation's coronavirus recovery, which, given South Korea's successful response to the containment of the outbreak using certain tracking technologies, though notably not a tracing app, and what I've seen of people's most recent behaviour, this might actually probably be true. Who would have suspected a faraway classist government who built a country on the backs of the underclass of poor people who idolise rebels, who cherish criminal bloodlines and working class heroes, and whose primary cultural exports are based on criminals and post-apocalyptic doomsday scenarios, couldn't be trusted to listen to a government with a history of open deception and class warfare? It's weird, right? One day, our grandchildren, our grandnieces and nephews, for those of us who refuse to birth a Furiosa into seemingly the inevitable hellscape of a Mel Gibson franchise spin-off, this unsurprisingly has caused a few doubts in the minds of ordinary Australians. Despite their recent excellent handling of technologies, seems we are just looking for things to complain about. Bunch of contrarian whingers. Deputy Chief Officer, and not the Paul Kelly that you're thinking, Paul Kelly, has not ruled out making the government's coronavirus tracing app compulsory for all Australians. Meaning, we will not only know who will be making the gravy, but who was standing nearby and who ate the infected gravy after it was served. Presumably, it'll function like that time Apple forced a bunch of us to have the U2 album, but less irritating. And it stands a chance of simultaneously saving your life while narking on you to the government, which, if I am honest, I wouldn't put past Bono. Morrison said at least 40% of Australians would have to download the app for it to be effective. Probably it'd also help if the app was functioning upon release. Look, here's the thing. I cannot tell you whether or not to download it. I want to. It's all I want to do. But I can't. That would be irresponsible. And I'm not part of the Liberal government. All I can do is give you some facts. Sexy, sexy facts. Oh, yeah. Seems like it has a lot of bugs. And issues like having entire states not included in the code seems like a pretty big issue. Look, this code, granted, is from a section that isn't active. But it says a lot about the potential problems hidden within the code. And unfortunately, unlike new video games, we can't just wait for them to sort the bugs out by having a bunch of excited new users tweeting the government directly with flaws that they've noticed so that they can make it better by next week. Because, let's face it, by next week, we'll have had another dozen beach gatherings or police parties. The best that I can do is to show you what other countries have tried and what has worked. So let's go around the world the only way that we can, fearfully hiding behind our computer screens so we don't get infected. First, the origin of the Trace App's code, Singapore. The patient zero of this problematic code, Singapore's Trace Together, is the basis on which Australia's own app has been built. With even Health Minister Greg Hunt citing aspects of Singapore's design as a cautionary tale of what not to do, with complaints about the app stating, even though it may still be open and running in the background, the app cannot make contact when a user is using another app, such as email or messaging services, or scrolling through social media feeds, or partaking in the ancient practice of making a phone call, or even daring to have your phone locked. Fortunately, social distancing will stop any would-be muggers from getting close enough to you to steal your now permanently unlocked phone. Next, we move to the UK. Look, the UK is still in the midst of developing a tracing app, and it will hopefully be available for use by mid-May. Moving on to the world's current punching bag, China. China has had some strong responses. Signs displaying QR codes are displayed at public checkpoints, including office buildings, shopping centres, bus and train stations, and airports. Users are required to scan the QR code with their phones, a thing that we all definitely still do and isn't at all an outdated technology. And then we've got to wait for their device to display a color-coded signal to determine whether they can pass. A green code allows their user unrestricted movement, something rarely seen in China in non-pandemic times, so pretty good. A yellow or orange code requires 7 days of quarantine, or if you go really fast, you can pretend you just didn't see it. Whereas, if the code returned is red, the user is determined to be either a confirmed case of COVID-19 or a close contact and must be placed in isolation. This often resulted in door bolting, wrist banding for ease of public shaming, and alleged underreporting of numbers to keep the cases lower in the public eye, as well as controlling people's movement. The app has also contact tracing mechanisms in place to notify users if they come into contact with infected people.
South Korea.
South Korea was wildly successful in using mobile phone location data along with the country's CCTV and credit card transaction records. So authorities would then retrospectively track the movements of people who later tested positive. The routes taken by people later confirmed as infected were often published online, while a push notification will be sent to the phones of the people who had visited the same locations. Unless, of course, it was, say, the Park family, who struggled to even get their own Wi-Fi signals, so it would be impossible to track them via GPS. Over to Taiwan, if you even believe such a place exists. The location data of anyone required to quarantine at home is monitored to ensure compliance. If the device monitored is switched off for 15 minutes or longer, an alert is sent to the authorities, as is evidenced by this tweet, which shows that the authorities showed up at this person's house in less than an hour after their phone died at 7:30 a.m., prompting the question, what were they doing that caused their phone to run out of battery before 7:30 a.m.? On to Germany now. German authorities initially backed a locally produced tracing model, which was set to store data on a central server. But authorities backflipped on this plan after criticism from privacy advocates. The country now will collaborate with Apple and Google in developing a Bluetooth tracing app that will see data stored on users' phones instead. In Israel, the app is similar to the Australian version in that it stores users' data on their devices, and users who are subsequently diagnosed with coronavirus must decide whether to release their location data to the authorities. Israeli authorities were also initially using phone location data to monitor the movements of potential virus carriers, until the practice has halted due to privacy concerns. I'm noticing a little bit of a theme here. Meanwhile, over in Hong Kong, similar technology is used to enforce the quarantine, with users required to wear a wristband with the unique QR code, just like in China, that pairs with their smartphone. Users download an app called Stay Home Safe, which uses geofencing technology to track their movements. And at random points throughout the day, the user is required to use their phone to scan their wristband to ensure the user hasn't left their phone at home. You know, like a creepy stalker who requests photos of you during the day, or at least that's what movies tell me. Now, given some of Hong Kong's more recent activities, this might become something that the government considers making a somewhat more permanent introduction to the daily life of Hong Kong. And finally, Center for Controlled Chaos and Confused Country, America, or as it will be known by future generations, New Coronia. There is a strong battle between state and federal control of states. No talk of an app has even been entertained at a federal level, but developers are pitching their apps directly to state and local governments. So in North and South Dakota, they are pursuing a similar model after a local startup repurposed its existing Bison Tracker app, originally designed to connect fans of North Dakota State University's athletic team. In Utah, the social media company 20 sold state officials on the approach combining Bluetooth with satellite-based GPS signals that would let trained health workers help connect the dots and discover previously hidden clusters of infection. Now, of course, American companies, in terms of origin, not so much in consideration of tax purposes, Apple and Google say apps built to their specifications will work across most iPhones and Android devices, eliminating compatibility problems. They have also forbidden governments to make the apps compulsory and are building in privacy protections to keep stored data out of government and corporate hands and ease concerns about surveillance. Because, you know, they already know everything about you. They were collecting your data well before it was cool. And Apple definitely needs you to get back behind the Genius Bar, though, let's be honest, Google has undoubtedly been killing it in the information collection racket since lockdown started. They know
all the weird things you've been Googling. So there is a lot of information to consider. Again, I can't tell you what to do. We are currently 6 million people short of the required 40%. But then some of the people have uninstalled it, so numbers may be artificially inflated, you know, like a RoboDebt. Oh, while we're talking about RoboDebt, just quickly, I will note that the COVID Safe app is being headed by father of RoboDebt himself and man practicing his parcel tongue, Stuart Robert. And personally, I am reluctant to get on board with anything overseen by the Voldemort of Centrelink. But this is just me. I can't tell you if you should download the app or not. You need to make up your own mind. But if we don't get the numbers, what happens? Well, the government may step in, and angry stepdad struggling to connect with a troubled teen and Prime Minister Scott Morrison has offered the ultimate carrot on a stick for a country whose first currency was rum, saying the sooner we all get on board and download the app, the sooner we can open up the pubs. Which really is of highest incentive for people running to be Prime Minister. And with us looking at an election by 2020 or whenever it is that they find the ceremonial backstabbing knife again, it is after all imperative to a prime ministerial campaign to be seen drinking a beer at some point. So, Morrison has gone full dad mode, saying that he will take away our favourite toy unless we sit in our houses and think about what we've done. But look, if they can fix it, and if they can get those assurances that we as a public really need, and if they can do it quickly, we should probably download it and try to save some lives. But if I'm honest with you, I can't tell you what to do right now. Moving on. Now on to the man being the man news. Flight Centre is trying its hand at becoming the newest airline taking the place of Virgin Airlines by charging its customers a $300 cancellation fee for each element of their journey that they had to cancel. Annoyingly, this disproportionately affects organised people who are capable of thinking ahead and making even the slightest semblance of a plan by booking flights ahead of time and not booking them as per the whims of Hermes, the Greek god of sleep, travel, and gap years abroad, and just going with the flow, man. Flight Centre asked one family to pay $2,100 cancellation fees for a $1,600 Disneyland hotel refund. On a trip to Disneyland, you expect that the company who's going to try and rip you off the most is Disneyland, then followed closely by the taxi on the way to Disneyland. It's a bold maneuver for a business that is already more redundant than MySpace. That, my friends, is a joke so outdated that half the people who hear it will have to ask Jeeves what a MySpace is just to understand it. This crisis has prompted questionable behaviour, also known as creative customer service, from the travel agent's drunk cousin, tour operators. One such drunk cousin, Top Deck, a youth travel operator, altered its refund policy and applied it retrospectively in a way that denied its customers refunds. Intrepid was also caught altering its refund policy and applying it to past bookings, like the shittiest multiverse outcome of a Back to the Future style shenanigan. Legally, I suspect, I have to mention that the company says it is not denying refunds and it is still working with individuals to resolve their concerns. But that currently is taking the shape of telling some customers who still want refunds to wait 3 months before asking again. Some top-level can-kicking worthy of challenging the gold medal champion of can-kicking, Big Daddy Climate Change. Flight Centre has announced it will no longer charge the fee in a public statement that simply said, "Ah, you noticed that, huh? Can we just keep the money anyway?" Altering the refund conditions to, if the travel provider cancels its service, meaning the airline or tour operator
has to cancel the trip. A customer who booked through Flight Centre will no longer be charged the $300 fine. Now, I can't say I don't get it. That is why every episode of Bearer of Weird News has a $300 fee for not listening the whole way through. And this is applied to all past and future episodes. So if you could just send that money to Matt, care of theinternet.com, that'd be great. All this, however, is secondary to the greater question, who is still using travel agents? Scam news now. A new report from Scamwatch claims that Generation Z is the most scammed generation. The report claims Australians under 25 lost over $5 million to scams in 2019, and reports made from this age group are increasing faster than older generations. Now, the report fails to take into account that Gen Z are likely the only ones who know how to report the scams, and thus the increase in scams reported by the last generation of humans makes sense. ACCC Deputy Chair Delia Rickard said, "In many cases, if you receive a sextortion threat from a stranger claiming they have compromising images or video footage of you, these images don't actually exist, so delete the message. If you're concerned, you can contact the eSafety Commissioner." Now, having been on the receiving end of such an email before, I am always amazed at the level of doublethink necessary to simultaneously think that I was stupid enough to fall for an email scam, yet tech-savvy enough to know how to create a Bitcoin. And while $5 million is a lot of money to take from a generation of underemployed workers trying to get out from under a mass amount of debt accrued by a system that won't give them a high-paying job without an education, but won't give them an education unless they are undertaking a life of crippling debt, well, at least these scammers are upfront about what they want, rather than pretending they are preparing you for a better life while training you for jobs that won't exist by the time you graduate due to the increasing automation of the workforce and the increasing casualization of jobs and the dissolving of contracts and the disruption of industries. The only reason these scams are brought to our attention is that they're not the legal scams. I mean, I can understand why Gen Z keep falling for these scams. They are honestly incapable of avoiding the allure of a good challenge. Enter the latest contender in the challenge market, the Piss Your Pants Challenge. Originally done by 19-year-old Liam Wire, who was attempting to get his 15 minutes of fame by proving that people will do anything for their 15 minutes of fame, but because he did it to prove a point, it doesn't count as just doing anything to get your 15 minutes. But hey, as long as you get your 2 million likes. Now, to the finance desk, with the latest Fuck the Poor report from the Fuck the Poor news desk. As the Morrison government has been so adamant in claiming the best kind of welfare is a job, thoroughly demonstrating that Scott Morrison has no real understanding that a job is not capitalist welfare. It is when you get yelled at by strangers and aren't allowed to say anything back because you have to pay rent. The government has been talking a lot about JobKeeper and the extension of JobSeeker due to the coronavirus. Now, the usual JobSeeker payment is roughly $40 a day, but that has been doubled for the next 6 months, for the foreseeable duration of the crisis. This $40 a day is an amount previously stated by the coalition to be able to be lived off. At the exact same time all these statements were being made, Barnaby Joyce was claiming that the $211,000 that he makes was not enough to raise two families on. And so while they were busy claiming that this was plenty of money to be lived off of, and at the same time that the best form of welfare was a job, even trying to Jedi mind trick us by asking us continuously, hey, how good are jobs? And talking about introducing a drug test for recipients of New Start and of youth allowance, which, if you ask me, is a waste of money. Because surely, if we're going to fund these guys, we want them at peak form. We want the Lance Armstrong of welfare recipients. Remember Lance? We loved him. We loved him before we found out he was taking drugs. Why would we ruin our welfare recipients for ourselves? But then most recently, they openly admitted that this is not supposed to be enough to live off, and then that is the point. Look guys, openly admitting the cruelty of the system is a bold take, but I guess they're counting on there being enough distraction by this greater evil abound that we'll easily lose focus on what's going wrong. They then fall back on the same age-old question, where does the money come from? If we're going to increase New Start permanently, or Job Seeker as it's now called, permanently, where does the money come from? A question that's been stumping parents and quiet Australians for as long as there have been questions to ask. Seems every time there is talk of raising the Job Seeker payment, this same idea comes up. When last I heard Morrison have an opinion on it, you know, back in the before times, he said, if the Labor Party thinks it should be increased, well, tell us how much and how you're going to pay for it and what you're going to change. Just be honest with the people. I am. He said this while forgetting to inform the people that he has failed to get taxes from some of the biggest tax dodgers in Australia, corporations, and that the value of the tax from billion-dollar businesses would be more than enough to cover the raise to New Start. That would look more like a form of capitalist welfare, if you asked me. And we might even kick in a Christmas bonus for him every time he manages to get these big businesses to pay their taxes. A little incentive for him to work harder. Professor Peter Whiteford of the Australian National University Crawford School analysed Australia's unemployment benefits, if you can call choosing between rent and food a benefit. He examined the welfare amounts before the crisis, and then he found them to be well below the OECD average. The doubling of JobSeeker has been the most significant change to Social Security in Australia since the welfare was introduced in the 1940s. And I don't know about you, but I like my social programs like I like my housing prices, stuck in the 1940s. Moving on now to the What's Left of Sports desk. Look, I don't really do a lot of sports in life, but the coronavirus has caused the world of sports to just fall apart, and particularly in Australia, where the only thing more important than sports is coal. Frankly, if we were able to keep sports happening during lockdown, we, as a country, would never ask to be let out again. And as we continue to figure out what a post-pandemic world will look like, what will be important, and what will get a new and surprising level of respect, I'm looking at you, supermarket workers. We head to the wide world of esports. Esports, yes. The esports of sports is finally getting the boost of legitimacy it needs to get that bump into being considered a real sport. With an event that was described as the first of its kind in Victoria, esports match fixing. Aussie, Aussie, Aussie. A group of six 19 to 22-year-old men from Mill Park,
hey, hometown represent,
a suburb in Melbourne's outer north, have been charged with two accounts of engaging in conduct that corrupts or would corrupt a betting outcome. Two counts of using corrupt conduct information for betting purposes and possessing cannabis. So that's a double whammy,
because we get a match-fixing charge and a doping charge at the same time. So these guys are really the Russian Winter Olympics team of esports, just trying to do their hometown proud. The game that they were match-fixing was Counter-Strike Global Operation, a game series set in, as far as I know, a series of non-specific war zones, making these crimes the least reprehensible things to have happened in non-war war zones. Frankly, we should be getting behind this sort of behaviour. We love an underdog. We love a good outlaw. Your Ned Kelly types, your Kerry Packer types. Oh, and don't forget your Rupert Murdochs, good old outlaws. We need to celebrate these failed sports stars, like failures of the past. We went so far as to name an ice rink after gold medal failure Stephen Bradbury and an STD clinic after Shane Warne. Aussie, Aussie, Aussie! I assume you have filled in the call and response, as is your duty, with any dully patriotic chant. Moving on to anti-vax political party news now. The Involuntary Medication Objectors Party, a party I also didn't know existed, and I make an effort to vote below the line, has announced that it will be changing its, admittedly, confrontational name, and will now be known as the Informed Medical Options Party. Australian Medical Association's Victoria President Julian Wright said that the AEC decision was disappointing and maintained that the name could mislead voters. You know, much like naming a major conservative party the Liberal Party. But AEC Acting Assistant Commissioner Joanne Reed found that the party's request was in accordance with Section 129, which provides that a name must not be obscene or likely to be confused or mistaken for the name of a recognised political party. This is regardless of whether or not it misleads people, as long as it doesn't confuse people into voting for the wrong party. Though I would argue, if they are looking to vote for an anti-vaxxer party, they are already voting for the wrong party. To be honest, if these guys are truly advocating for informed options like they claim, then they should change their name to something that even further hides what their true agenda is. Maybe something like the "Hey, we totally care if you live" party. Because really, that would force their supporters to do some proper research like they claim they want. And finally, Donald Ducking news. Hold on to your butts. We are learning more and more as the days go on about how the coronavirus spreads, and the latest updates about how the virus spreads is it could spread through farts. Dr. Norman Swan, the health editor for the ABC in Australia, has revealed the silent but deadly threat of spreading coronavirus through farts. Now, it is not just the cabbage and the Brussels sprouts that your partner needs to worry about. With the good doctor warning.
So I think that what we should do in terms of social distancing and being safe is that a policy on the part of the entire Australian population should be that you don't fart close to other people and that you don't fart with your bottom bare.
This is excellent advice.
This has led to a nationwide debate about Dutch ovens and cupcaking. Should such practices be banned, or like so many precious items in the supermarket, will there be a ban on no more than one fart per day, kept at a responsible social distance? Will this be the end of fart humour? Or will, as does tend to happen with bans, there still be secret clubs at the questionable end of town where the edgy performers talk openly about the days when you used to be able to fart without scrutiny, how this political correctness has gone mad and they won't be muffled? Going out of their way to eat lots of eggs and then crop dust an entire tram. As society divides into two factions, those who Donald Duck and those who Mickey Mouse. Obviously, Donald Ducking is the well-known trend of wearing a shirt without pants, as we're Mickey Mousing, is the reverse of a Donald Duck. It's a pants with no shirt. Fortunately, Dr. Norman Swan has also provided us with a little relief, as underpants act as a butt mask. So this will have devastating impacts on the crotchless panties and G-string markets, which will certainly change the way we think about the future of strip clubs, even if they are being conducted via drive-thrus. How will we go forward when everyone is carrying a potential biological weapon with them? Well, enter the canary in the coal mine of the coronavirus pandemic, man's best friend. And like any good friend, you go out of your way to get them a job when you see that they don't have much going on. Question is, can dogs smell coronavirus? Well, truth is, we don't know yet. Researchers at the University of Pennsylvania have enlisted 8 Labrador retrievers to see if they can detect an odor unique to SARS-CoV-2, the virus responsible for the COVID-19. Because dogs not only have a history of being able to smell other diseases like Parkinson's and some cancers, they just love sniffing butts. You can't stop them. Even when you're just sitting around at home on a Zoom call, they love to put their nose where it doesn't need to be. A report from the Washington Post says, assuming they are successful in picking up the scent of the virus, they may be able to form a canine surveillance corp, a paw patrol, if you will. This approach could offer a quick, non-invasive method to screen persons in hospitals, businesses, airports, train stations, and as well as ports of entry, and obviously the major port of exit, the anus. I'm not sure about how non-invasive this will be, as I have had some nosy pets in my time who don't quite understand the necessity, as we understand it now, of social distancing. And if they are being trained by the police, well, the police aren't exactly known for their non-invasive methods of getting the job done. Just ask anyone who has attended a music festival in the last 5 years. I just hope that they remember to put a face mask on as they ask me to bend over and cough so they can get a proper picture of the situation. Those dogs' noses are real cults sometimes. I am, however, looking forward to the inevitable medical drama about dogs on the front line of a pandemic. I've been workshopping titles, and you, the listener, can vote for your favourite. Here they are. E-Arf. The good doctor. The very good doctor. Yes, you are. Yes, you are. Obviously, that one's a little bit long, but it does run off the tongue quite naturally. Nurse Jack Russell. Doghouse. Dogtours. Doggy Hauser MD. And Greyhound's Anatomy. Alrighty guys, thank you so much for your time. Thanks for making it all the way to the end. Thanks for listening to another episode of The Bearer of Weird News. If this is your first time, however, thank you. Thanks for making it all the way through, and we hope you come back. It's been a very hard time. It's been a very weird time. And I hope that this little bit of news and information helps you get through the day. Some of you are working from home, and I appreciate you doing that. Some of you still have to commute to work, and I especially appreciate you doing that. Stay safe out there. Look after each other, please wash your hands, and if you feel like it, check out my comedy special on Fringe View, only available until the end of May, so thanks a lot.